the recording, yes. Okay.
And Shiraz will tell us about black holes and gauges.
Okay. So for the next four lectures, you're stuck with me. Yes. The next four of my lectures, you're stuck with me. I'm going to be lecturing on black holes and Yang-Mills theory. So let me say what I mean by that before giving you an outline of my talks. As you know, quantum theories of gravity are mysterious in many ways. Some of the mysteries of quantum gravity, several of them, have to do with space-times that have singularities. Examples of space-times that have singularities are space-times with black holes on them. Okay? Black holes are mysterious objects in many ways. We've been familiar with them for almost a century, but they're still mysterious. Aspects of their physics are still mysterious. Now, over the last 10 years, we have what should be a new approach, a new tool to ask old, important questions about the mysteries of black hole physics. This new tool is ADS-CFT. Because, you see, as we've learned from the work of many people, I mean, most clearly Maldacena, in certain cases, some theories of gravity are just the same as ordinary gauge theories. Now, while theories of gravity may be mysterious in many ways, gauge theories, we now believe, are not. We understand gauge theories, in principle at least, very well. So, the idea of these lectures, and we won't get all the way, so don't get your hopes up, but the idea of these lectures is to use this fact to try to see what we can understand about interesting, mysterious questions about black hole physics by translating these questions into questions about gauge theory and seeing what we can say about the answers to these questions in gauge theory. You see, we'll learn some interesting things along the way. This program has not been completed at all, but it's an interesting program, and it's fun. Okay, so this is an outline of the lectures I plan to give. We'll first try to... this will be a lecture or a lecture and a half. I'll first describe the density of states of n equals 4 Yang-Mills theory. On a three sphere at large lambda, using what we know about the dual, and then try to calculate the same density of states at small lambda and the way this links with the topic of these lectures is that, as we will see, this density of states in some regime is dominated by black holes. So the gravitational density of states would be dominated by black holes. We'll try to compute the same quantity where we can engage theory at small lambda and see if there's any similarity between these two functions. We'll find a similarity and we'll find, well, something interesting. So this will be the first lecture and a half or so. We'll then switch modes in the next lecture to try to use another field theory-based approach to try to understand aspects of black hole physics. And this field theory-based approach will basically be fluid mechanics. Okay? So we'll try to understand other aspects of black hole physics in global ADS-5 cross S-5. The aspects we'll concentrate on is the behavior of thermodynamics for charged rotating black holes in ADS-5 process 5 using fluid mechanics, which emerges out of the study of local quantum field theories in a particular limit. So we'll try to understand other aspects of black hole physics in the second part using fluid mechanics. In the last part of the lectures, parts 1 and 2 are in ADS-5 cross S-5. They use the most familiar ADS-CFT duality, namely the duality between n equals 4 Yang-Mills theory and type 2B theory and ADS5 process 5. In part 3, we'll turn to another ADS-EFT source of duality, one that has been introduced in the school by David Kutasov in great detail, a duality between a confining Yang-Mills theory and a gravity background with a cigar in it. You know, this Witten background. Okay, that you've heard about last week. Okay, so we'll turn to Witten's background. Okay, and try to understand once again. So this gravity background is dual to a gauge theory that has an interesting property lacking in ADS5 cross S5, namely this gauge theory is confining. So we'll try to understand aspects of black hole physics in this background and the dual Yang-Mills manifestations of these black holes. We'll find new and interesting features when we do this. Okay. That's basically it. So that's the plan for these lectures. Through these lectures, it would be much more fun for me and for all of us, I'm sure, if we were stopped with lots of questions and comments and skeptical remarks all through. So please feel free, you know, just any time to stop me and to remark or to question or to be skeptical. Okay, great. So questions, comments, or skeptical remarks. Okay, great. So let's start. Okay. Over the last week and from your study of this very important aspect of physics in our field, all of you by now know that it has been established beyond reasonable doubt that there are two theories of physics that have different formulations, but in fact are the same theories of physics. The first one is N equals 4 Yang-Mills on a three sphere. This is a conformal field theory, so we can take the size of the three sphere to be anything we liked. It's the only length scale in the problem. Through my lectures, I'll take it to be 1. The radius of the three sphere will be 1. Okay, what are the parameters of this theory? Well, the parameters of this theory include a coupling constant. In the last lecture, Professor Tepper explained to us that ordinary QCD does not have a dimensionless coupling constant, although it appears to have one from the classical action, because of the running of the coupling constant. This aspect of physics is different for the N equals 4 theory, because N equals 4 Yang-Mills is a conformal field theory. The coupling constant does not run, and it's a genuine dimensionless number that characterizes the theory. So that's one of the parameters of the theory. It's dimensionless, it's G squared Yang-Mills. There's another parameter, which is N, namely the rank of the gauge group, the rank of the gauge group on which the Yang-Mills theory is based. As you've heard many times, it actually turns out to be more convenient to deal with a slightly different basis in the space of parameters. So we deal with lambda, the Toft coupling, and N. We do this because there's a sensible way. Well, physics is, it turns out to be useful and interesting to take the following limit, taking N to infinity while keeping lambda fixed. So let's keep taking G squared to 0, N to infinity, such that lambda is fixed. Okay, this is the Toft large N limit. Though ADS-EFT works for any value of lambda and any value of N, and therefore any value of G squared and any value of N, through most of my talk, I will be using ADS-EFT to compare with gravity, and I will be working in the Toft limit, where we take N large and lambda large, but N large first. You know, N to infinity first, and then lambda taken to be large, sort of nearly infinite, but second. First, the limit n goes to infinity. Okay, so this is one side of the story. N equals 4 Yang-Mills and an S3. These are the parameters of the theory. Two dimensionless parameters. Okay. N is discrete, but in the large n limit, 1 over n is almost continuous. Good. The second side of the story is 2B theory on ADS5 plus S5. Okay, so let me remind you what ADS5 plus S5 is, largely in order to set notation. So the metric of ADS5, global ADS, takes the following form. There's an overall radius outside, and then we have time. So we've got a radial variable rho that runs from 0 to infinity. Rho equals infinity is the boundary of our space. Okay? This time and the S3 that surrounds any point in ADS, the time factor and the S3 factor that surround any point in ADS have a warp factor that depends on rho. So we've got a cos squared rho behind dt squared and a sine a squared rho behind the S3 squared. Okay? The point rho equals 0 is a point that I will, by abuse of proper gravitational usage, often refer to as the center of ADS. This is abuse of gravitational usage because ADS5 is a homogeneous space. Every point is as good as any other. But once we've chosen a particular, we've made a particular choice of what our energy is. And for us, energy will be the killing vector, you know, the charge that's conjugate to the killing vector d by dt. Then there's a special point, the point where a particle at rest has the lowest possible energy in the space. Okay, that's the center of ADS, this point rho equals 0. Okay, so this is ADS5. In addition, we also have, in our metric, an S5. Okay, great. It's the same radius that occurs behind ADS5 and S5. Now, unlike in N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, the radius of this space is not something you can just scale away. That's because string theory, unlike N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, has an intrinsic length scale in it, namely the string coupling constant, as the string length scale, the string scale. Okay? So while the radius itself is not terribly important, what is important is the dimensional ratio between this radius and the string scale. So one of the parameters of this theory is r divided by square root of alpha prime, which up to some number, which will not be important for anything I have to say, is identified according to the ADS-EFT dictionary with lambda to the 1/4, where lambda was the Tofts coupling up here. The second important parameter in string theory is the string coupling constant. That is automatically dimensionless. It's G string, which is identified, again up to a number which will not be important in anything in this talk, with G squared Yang-Mills, which is the same thing as lambda divided by A. Okay? So these are the two sides of the correspondence, N equals 4 Yang-Mills and an S3, and type 2 V theory and ADS5 plus S5. Perhaps the last element of the dictionary that I want, well, I should also tell you how quantities in one side transform to quantities in the other. The only quantity I will be interested in, the only quantities I will be interested in are conserved charges. In the two theories. And for the first lecture, I'll be interested in only one conserved charge, namely the energy. So I should just tell you what the energy for Yang-Mills on a three-sphere of unit radius, so E, I'll call that E Yang-Mills, what that translates to in this space. And this is simply E d by dt. The energy conjugate to the killing vector d by dt in this space, written as I've written. Okay, now, there's an important physical point here that we'll use again and again, and that's this. d by dt is not a proper energy anywhere in space. However, at rho equals 0, and as we will see, it will turn out that most of our excitations in the theory are confined to the neighborhood of rho equals 0. At rho equals 0, this object is very simply related to a proper energy. Okay, so the proper energy of something at rho equals 0 at, let's say, rho equals 0 is equal to E d by dt divided by R ADS. This R here. Okay, this is just accounting for the gravity, you know, well, the change of scale, basically, between d by dt and r, and using the fact that cos square rho is 1 at rho equals 0. Okay? Good. So, this d by dt was basically E Yang-Mills. Proper energies in the space-time are related to Yang-Mills energies.
There was a question.
Please.
What about units? Because r has a...
Well, you see, the way I've written it, the E gauge theory is dimensionless, because we've taken the radius of our sphere to be 1. Okay? So, this is dimensionless. This has 1 over distance. Therefore, this is energy. Okay? Great. Very good. So, now that we've got this clear, what I'm going to try to do in the next 10 minutes is try to use... You see, ADS-CFT is a solution of Yang-Mills theory. It's a solution of Yang-Mills theory at large n. I want to read from that solution an interesting property of n equals 4 Yang-Mills theory at large n. The interesting property that I want to read off is the entropy as a function of energy of n equals 4 Yang-Mills theory at large n and large lambda. Okay, so how do I do that? Well, all I have to do is to go to the gravitational theory and to ask what kind of excitations this theory has. Well, if you think about it, there are at least three distinct classes of excitations in type 2B theory on ADS 5 cross S5. So the first class, which is appropriate at low energies, and we'll see how low soon, is gravitons. By which I really mean supergravitons, and these supergravitons propagate in all of ADS 5 cross S5. Okay. Now, at low enough energies, as we will see in a moment, these are the only excitations of the theory, the only states of the theory. Okay? And I want to count the entropy as a function of energy that we get from gravitons. Well, this is a very easy problem. It's a very easy problem once you remember that physics in ADS is essentially the physics in a box of size R ADS. Okay? So what we have here is a 10-dimensional gas, 10-dimensional massless gas in a box of size R ADS. Okay? And we want to compute its thermodynamics. Well, all of us know how to do that. We could do it, but we can do it even more simply than doing it by just doing dimensional analysis. You see, because massless gases have no dimensions in them. Okay, so suppose I want to write down a formula for the entropy of a massless gas in volume V. The entropy depends on volume and energy. How does it go? Well, firstly, entropy is dimensionless. So it can't depend on volume and energy separately. It must depend on a particular combination of volume and energy. Okay? Volume has dimensions length to the 9 in our space. So it must depend on V times e to the power 9. Must be some function of this. What function? Well, at large enough energies, energies large compared to the inverse length scale set by the volume, this function is determined by the fact that this quantity must be extensive. If energy scales like volume, the entropy must also scale like volume. So that sets this thing to be a power, and this power, you can easily check, is 1 by 10. Okay? This is a volume, this goes like volume to the 9, so that's volume to the 10 by 10, therefore like volume. Okay? So just dimensional analysis and the demand of extensivity tell you that this massless gas must have this entropy scaling like this with volume and energy. In our situation, volume is simply R ADS to the power 9. So we have R ADS times E to the power 9 by 10. So that's what we decided to call E Yang-Mills to the power 9 by 10. Of course, there are all kinds of numerical constants which depend on how many species you have of massless gas that we're not keeping track of in this crude analysis. Okay, so at low enough energies, the density of states, the entropy of the theory grows like e to the power 9 by 10, E Yang-Mills to the power 9 by 10 times a numerical constant that's independent of n and lambda. Great. That's great. But this state, this situation doesn't last forever. At some point, you get new excitations in your theory. What are these new excitations? Well, the lightest new excitations are string oscillators. Okay? So when do you see your first string oscillator in this theory? Okay, we know that the mass of closed string oscillator is the mass and therefore E proper of the lightest closed string oscillator is of order 1 over square root alpha prime. Okay? But this is E proper. We're interested in E Yang Mills. So we should multiply this by RADS, which, you remember, and you remember that this ratio was lambda to the 1/4. So at energy lambda to the 1/4, we see our first new excitations. Our first new excitation that's not accounted for by this formula. Okay. At higher energies, please.
What about the other zero mass excitations of two peak gravity? So gravity, like all the potentials, they just give a factor? Or?
Exactly. You see, this analysis applied to any massless 10-dimensional gas. Now, it's true that this particular massless 10-dimensional gas has, whatever, 256 components. So you get a factor here that is 256 times pi is times zeta functions. Okay? All that is independent of lambda, independent of A. Other questions, comments? Good. Okay. So we've got, at this energy, we've got new excitations. Now, once we go well above this energy, what is the entropy of these excitations? Well, this we know very well. You see, we're all very familiar with the fact that the entropy of string oscillator states is Hagedorn-like. Okay? The entropy is Hagedorn-like, which means that the entropy is proportional to the energy, and the proportionality constant is the string scale in a way that makes this formula dimensionless. All numbers of order 1 are being set to 1 here. It's just rough analysis to set the stage for something more precise. Okay. So this, once again, was E proper. Okay? We should convert E proper into E Yang-Mills. So we've got E Yang-Mills divided by alpha prime divided by R. And so this is the same as E Yang-Mills by lambda to the 1. Okay? So we've got another regime. This is much higher energies. Energies of order lambda to the 1/4, not energies of order 1 anymore. In which we've got a different behavior, a different growth in the density of states. Since this is a faster growth than e to the power 9 by 10, at some point, the density of states we get from here dominates over the gravitons, and we can forget about the gravitons at those energies. Okay. Now, if we go still higher in energy, we get further new excitations. And these new excitations are much more interesting than anything we've seen before. And is the reason for giving these lectures. These new excitations we don't quite understand in gravity, but we have a macroscopic description of. These new excitations are black holes. Okay. So at some point, when you heat the system up enough, or you put enough energy into it, you get an object that is reliably described as a black hole. At what point is this? Well, the black hole that you, just in classical gravity, it might seem like you could have a black hole of any mass. But this is not reliably described as a black hole unless it's larger than its Planck scale. Okay? So, So, once we get to a mass, you see, the size of the black hole being larger than Planck scale, same as the mass of the black hole being larger than Planck scale. Basically, because the only thing that converts between size and mass is Planck scale. You know, that's genuine. Okay, so once we get the mass that is order of the Planck scale, which in 10-dimensional string theory is 1 over square root alpha prime g string to the power 1/4, so that's E proper equals this, we'll have new stuff. You see, at this point, up to this point, we have tacitly been using the fact that in the large end limit, using this formula, g string, the coupling constant of the bulk theory is zero, and therefore all these excitations are free. So we've been in calculations in free theories, ignoring all gravitational interactions between them. Okay, now at this point, you see, that's always dangerous in gravity because the gravitational coupling constant is some power of energy times g string. So if you make your energy large enough, you can't ignore gravitational interactions, even if your string coupling constant is arbitrarily weak. Of course, you have to scale the energy to be inversely with the string coupling constant in order for that to happen. So this is the point when that starts happening in an important way. Okay? This energy now is E Yang-Mills is equal to R times the stuff, which, with 2 minutes of manipulation, you'll see is n to the 1/4. Okay? So for the first time, we've got n in the game. When we have energies of order n to the 1/4, we have new kinds of excitation, small black holes. And these objects now, will soon start to dominate the entropy of our system. Okay. Now, we should estimate the growth in entropy as a function of energy from small black holes. Okay, this is an easy exercise, but one that I will not take the 3 minutes to do here with you. I'll just write down. Well, I'll tell you how you could do it. You see, the Schwarzschild radius of a black hole to the power 7 is proportional to Newton's constant times the mass, but the area of a black hole is proportional to the Schwarzschild radius to the power 8, because that's area, divided by Newton's constant. You put these two things together, and you convert to E Yang Mills rather than E proper. So we've got entropy as a function of Schwarzschild radius, but you can eliminate Schwarzschild radius in favor of the mass, so that's E proper. Then you can substitute for E proper in terms of E Yang Mills. When you do all of that, you get some number times N squared times E by N squared to the pi by seven. Okay, so the third kind of excitation has an even faster growth in the density of states than Hagedorn. It has e to a positive power in the entropy. Now, if we were in something like flat space, this would be the end of the story, but of course we're not. At some point, the radius of these small black holes becomes comparable to the size of the S5 and the ADS5. At that point, approximating these black holes by black holes in flat space, as we've done for the purpose of these formulas, is inappropriate. You should actually use the formulas for black hole thermodynamics in ADS5 plus S5. And now I'll refer you to Mukund's last lecture, where he actually wrote down these black hole solutions and told you about their thermodynamics. And I won't try to do that in detail. But when you do, you find that for energies E Yang Mills larger than N squared, this, by the way, turns out to be where these small black holes have size of order the ADS radius, as would be easy to see if you plugged into this formula and converted to E Yang Mills. Though I'm not intending to do it unless somebody is very uncomfortable about it. Okay?
I have a quick question.
Please.
You're going too fast for me.
Please.
If I put E equals N to the 1/4 into this entropy, does it then agree with the entropy?
No. You see, there are two different crossover points. This is the point where you first can reliably say that you have black holes. It is not the point where black hole entropy dominates over the Hagedorn. We'll come to that in a moment.
So this isn't the correspondence.
This is not... No. We'll come to where that is in just a minute. But this is just where you first start new excitations. Okay? It was the same thing up here. You first had new excitations at energies of order lambda to the 1/4, but this will not be the energy at which these excitations dominate over the gravitons. Oh, just hang on 2 minutes and we'll see that. Yes. Okay. So finally, this formula should be thought of as a formula that is valid only when E by N squared is small. When E by N squared is large, instead you get S is equal to N squared to the power into E by N squared to the power 3/4. So crudely speaking, you should think of this power as a function of E by N squared, which interpolates between 8/7 and 3/4 at large energies. Okay, so that's a complete picture. That's a complete picture of the entropy as a function of energy, as far as we understand it. You know, these are the excitations that I have been able to identify, or people have been able to identify. There may be something new and mysterious at orders, some intermediate energy of order n or something like that we don't yet know about. But anyway, sticking to what we know, this looks like a complete picture of the entropy as a function of energy in this theory.
Where did the 3/4 come from?
Okay, I didn't tell you about that. That came from solving for the thermodynamics of large black holes in ADS5 plus S5. Okay, if you just did the same exercise, but with the real ADS5 plus S5 solution, okay, then you get that. Okay. Now let's look at this. So let's look at this result on a plot. Okay. So you see, what I should be doing, well, let me do something funny. I'll do something funny instead of the straightforward thing. What you now expect me to do is to plot entropy as a function of energy, and I could do that, but that plot looks a little strange, and it's not going to give me the interesting point that I want to make. Instead, what I'm going to do is to plot a funny object. 1 over del S by del E is a function of energy. Why am I doing that? I'm doing that because in thermodynamics, 1 over del S by del E is an interesting quantity. It's the temperature. So what I'm doing is plotting the temperature of these excitations as a function of their energy. Okay, now if you go through, you can, since we have S as a function of E in all of these plots, you can easily compute 1 over del S by del E, and you'll find the following shape. Okay, you'll find the following shape, where the actual functional values here are e to the power 1 by 10, lambda to the 1/4, 1 over e by n squared to the power 1 by 7, and e by n squared to the power 1 by 4. And now we can ask David's question, where are the correspondence points? And the correspondence points are, as you would expect, exactly where these two curves meet. And that turns out to be at, here, e is equal to lambda to the 5 by 2. And here, e is equal to n squared divided by lambda to the 7 by 4. And here, e is equal to x squared. Okay? So we have this interesting plot for the inverse, for the temperature versus the density of states of this theory. It's this nice shape that rises, falls, and rises again. What can we... Okay. Now, there are two things I want to emphasize about this plot. The first thing is the following. Everything here is described by free string theory with no interactions. Everything here is more interesting. It's string theory with interactions, and the stuff, the bulk description of all of this is black holes. Notice that we have to deal with interactions even though we're in the large n limit, basically because here we're interested in temperature as energies of order n squared. Now, you might think, well, if I'm taking n to be infinity, is it legal to be considering energies of order n squared? That's one of the reasons I've drawn this plot for you in terms of temperature. You see, in these phases, even though the energies of the theory are order n squared, temperatures are not. Temperatures are of order 1. Okay? So if you were interested in the question, what happens to Yang-Mills theory at a temperature 10 divided by the inverse radius of the sphere, you will be forced to be interested in energies of order n squared. Because that's what will dominate the answer, as we'll see in a moment. Okay? So I want to claim that there's nothing at all singular about these configurations with energies of order n squared, even in the large n limit. One way of saying that is that intensive thermodynamic quantities of this theory are of order 1 for these states.
Last crossover point, I mean, is that smooth?
Everything in this curve is smooth. Everything here is smooth. It's, you know, two competing curves which you have to superpose and you get something smooth. We're soon going to see something sharp, but in this curve so far, everything is smooth. Okay. Now, let's turn to Arjun's question. Another interesting question, and that's what I wanted to talk about, was that even though this curve, the entropy as a function of energy, is perfectly smooth, it gives rise to sharp discontinuities in thermodynamics. How do we see that? You see, suppose we were trying to compute the partition function of the system as a function of temperature. At low enough temperatures, there's only one option for the system. It has to lie here. It has to be in the thermal graviton phase. As you increase the temperature, the system develops new options. Past a critical temperature, it has three phases it could be in. And at even higher temperatures, once again, there's only one phase it could be in. Now, so it's interesting to ask where the system has the option of being in three different phases, which one does it pick? Okay. It's very easy to check that while the free energies of these two phases, this phase is always negative, and this phase can be negative, the free energy of this phase is always positive. It's related to the fact that this phase has negative rather than positive specific heat. This is not really a good candidate for a thermodynamic equilibrium of a system. Okay? So it's this guy or this guy. It turns out when you do the detailed calculation that, remember, as we'll see in more detail as we go on, the free energy of this phase is of order n squared times a function of temperature. We'll see this in more detail as we go on. Whereas the free energy of this guy is a function of temperature with no n squared behind it. So as soon as this function of temperature becomes negative, it is more negative than this guy. So the question is there a regime where the free energy here is positive and another regime where it's negative? Well, it had to be because this guy was positive and it's continuous. So it turns out to be yes. There's a sharp point, let's say this yellow line, at which the free energy of this phase becomes negative and therefore more negative than the free energy of this phase, and the system undergoes a phase transition. The low temperature behavior of the theory at temperatures below or up to the yellow curve is thermal gravitons. The high temperature behavior of the theory at temperatures above or up to the yellow curve is a big black hole in ADS space. Okay? So, although the density of the entropy as a function of energy of the system is completely smooth, the partition function of free energy as a function of the temperature undergoes a sharp discontinuity. This discontinuity is really sharp because we're in the large n limit. Okay? You've got two competing saddles, but one has action which is n squared, the other one has action that's 1, so it's sharp in the large n limit. Okay, so the free energy's function of temperature undergoes an interesting sharp phase transition. The phase transition is a phase transition towards black hole nucleation. Okay, and sounds like a very interesting thing. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about the density of states as a function of energy and how black holes show up in this picture before turning to Yang-Mills theory. Now, any questions or comments before that? Please.
Curve in between, does it really make sense given that there's three sort of phases?
This one?
Yes.
Please elaborate.
Because when we studied statistical mechanics and there was such transitions, the curve in between is not meaningful.
Okay. Yes. I think though that there's an element here. You see, I think what Professor Seiberg is talking about is a phase separation. Okay, so, but there's an element here that doesn't mesh with phase separation, and that's the fact that you can't have half of a big black hole. You see, the entropy of the big black hole is an entropy of that object. Okay, so, Okay, let me answer them this way. Suppose you were interested in the entropy of the system as a function of energy. If you were at this energy here, you don't have enough energy to produce a black hole at all. Okay? So suppose you were interested not in the canonical ensemble, but the microcanonical ensemble. Then, at these energies, there's nothing else it could be but Hagedorn. See, you don't have enough energy to produce even the smallest black hole that you can legitimately call a black hole, which is n to the 1/4. So I think in the microcanonical ensemble, in this system, this is indeed physical. If you were taking the system and turning up the energy, increasing it, you would run through this phase. Until you got energies of order n squared, you would not see black holes. There's no sense in which you'd see half a black hole and half of the gravitons. Is this?
And what about the negative specific?
I think the same is true of the negative specific heat. If you were looking at the system as a function of energy, you would run through a phase where you were dominated by these small black holes. Okay. Of course, you never see that in the canonical ensemble. But I don't see any way out of the conclusion that you would see this phase of apparently negative specific heat at a particular energy. You know, you don't have enough energy to make black holes with positive specific heat, but you do have enough energy to make these black holes, and they dominate your entropy.
But you can separate two.
You can separate two of them?
You can separate it like that.
Yes, but then you still have a gas of black holes with negative specific heat. The zero mode part is subdominant in all of this. Right, I mean, the zero mode part gives you some power law correction to the partition function that would be a logarithmic correction to all of this. So the best thing you could do is to you could separate it into many, many very small things. I think that would be subdominant in entropy. For the same reason that in flat space, if you have a certain amount of energy, the best you can do is put it all into a single black hole. And all of these formulas are just for black holes effectively in flat space in this region. So I think that would be subdominant in entropy. I think the dominant entropy configuration, you don't agree. Tell me why, please.
Why can't you go to a large black hole at the bottom of this curve and the rest fix the energy very far?
Yeah, but the large black hole at the bottom of this curve has larger energy than you have in your system. You see, this is a function of energy. So let's say that here, this is energy n squared. Let's say you have energy which is n squared divided by a million. Okay, say you have energy that's n squared divided by a million. You don't have enough energy to produce a large black hole. You see, it's very different in ordinary statistical mechanics because there you're talking about a translationally invariant system and you're talking about energy density. So there you can take some part of the space and put that phase and another part of the space and put another phase. That's not what we have here. You just don't have enough energy to produce a single large black hole. I think that's just... there's nothing you can do. Okay. Okay. So great.
is this really needed? just a bit.
Hey, that's something that you had me.
Go in there, and this fuzzy thing. And you're all set.
Great. Okay. So now we're going to turn. So this is very interesting behavior that encompasses a whole gamut of the excitations of string theory, including the relatively tame string oscillators and the relatively interesting black holes. So now what we're going to ask is, can we see hints of this behavior in Yangler's theory? Of course, we would like to just solve n equals 4 Yangler's theory directly and find black holes, but we're poor men. All we can do is weak coupling. So can we see hints of this behavior as weak coupling in Yangler's theory? Okay, so that's going to be the rest of this lecture and perhaps a bit of the next one. So, although the most interesting and the most informative part of the story was entropy as a function of energy, in perturbation theory, in a field theory, the easiest quantity to compute is something that in principle contains all of this information, which is the partition function as a function of the temperature. Now we all know how to compute partition functions as functions of temperatures using path integrals. Using path integrals, this was reviewed for you in this school by Larry Yaffe, among other people perhaps. So I'll just remind you of the prescription. Using path integrals, what you have to do is the following. Consider n equals 4 Yangmills on S3 times S1. S3 because that's our spatial manifold. S1 because we want to put the theory on finite temperature. The theory is going to be Euclidean. Okay, then do the path integral of the theory on this manifold, taking the size of the S1, the circumference, the 2 pi r, to be equal to beta, which is 1 over the temperature. Okay, and the path integral you do is just the usual path integral. The only thing a little different about it from some things you may have seen is that it's Euclidean. So that's what we want to do. We want to compute z of beta by doing this path integral. Simple. Okay. So, good. So suppose you were actually trying to compute this path integral, of course, a finite coupling is, I mean, how do you do it? However, as we've said, we're willing to settle, to begin with, for a computation of this path integral at weak coupling. So let's try to do it at arbitrarily weak coupling and see if we can do it there. Okay. Now, at arbitrarily weak coupling, you might think you're in business. You might think you're in business because you might think that all you have to do at weak enough coupling is to compute a determinant. Let me remind you why you might think that. In any quantum field theory, if you've got a quadratic term and some higher order stuff, which is suppressed by a coupling constant. Okay? And you want to do a path integral like this. Contributions from these terms are coupling constant suppressed. So you might think that the only kind of path integral you need to do is a quadratic path integral. That, therefore, is a determinant. However, there is one potential subtlety here, which is very important to keep in mind. And that is this. You see, the true coupling constant of the theory, the coupling constant that suppresses higher loop graphs compared to lower loop graphs, is not really the coefficient of the nonlinear term. That wouldn't be invariant under field redefinitions. It's actually the coefficient of the nonlinear term once you have normalized your field so that the quadratic term has coefficient 1. Okay, so it's an appropriate ratio of the coefficient of the nonlinear term and the coefficient of the quadratic term. Now, that's fine. It doesn't bother you in any situation except when there are modes in your theory where the coefficient of the quadratic term goes very small, either inversely with the coupling or even more seriously when it's 0. In that situation, if you were doing an integral like this, no matter how small lambda was, this integral is not well approximated by a determinant. You can absorb lambda into phi. It's not a parameter of that integral. Okay? So this is a general thing you always have to be careful about in doing physics. You have to watch out for zero modes. Okay? And we have to watch out for them here as well. Okay. So, the first question we should ask in trying to do this computation is, do we have zero modes in our problem? And when you think about it a little bit, the answer is clear. You see, n equals 4 Yang-Mills has gauge fields, scalars, and fermions. You might think that constant values of the scalar and the sphere, constant on the sphere and in time, are zero modes, but that's not true. Because n equals 4 Yang-Mills on the sphere includes mass terms that are forced on you by conformal invariance. Include terms that are r squared times phi squared. So the scalars are effectively massive. So even the zero modes of the scalars, the path that has no dependent space appears in the quadratic action. Okay? It's similarly true, well, for slightly different reasons, but it's also true that when you look at the fermions and the spatial components of the gauge fields, and you expand them in Kaluza-Klein modes on the sphere and Fourier modes in time, all of the components of these objects have masses. However, we also have the time component of the gauge field. The time component of the gauge field, as far as the sphere is concerned, is a scalar, but it does not have the conformal mass term, because it comes just from the Yang-Mills Lagrange. Okay? So there is a mode in the problem, namely the mode that is A0, which is constant in the S3 and constant in the S1. Okay? That is, in the classical action, exactly. Okay? There's a more invariant way of saying this. There's a more invariant way of saying this, and that's this. That if you just looked at S Yang-Mills and asked, is it positive definite? The answer is yes, it's positive, but not definite. Because there are configurations, namely holonomy of A0 around flat connections in this theory. Holonomies of A0 around the circle that have the same action, namely 0, as all fields set to 0. Okay? So that's the same thing said in slightly more fancy terms. Okay, so while at weak enough coupling, we'd be well justified in doing the path integral over all other modes of the theory as a determinant at one loop. We must be careful to deal with this zero mode of this holonomy exactly. Okay? Because there's no sense, at least until we've understood what the dynamics of this is, there's no sense in which we can a priori treat it perturbatively. Okay, so that's the most interesting complication of this problem. It has an interesting physical reason, which we'll get to at some point. But that's why this is an interesting problem, and can give us interesting physics. As we will see when we deal with this problem, even at arbitrarily weak coupling, we will find a phase transition that mirrors some of the aspects of the black hole creation phase transition. How can we do that? Well, you never have interesting physics when you're doing an integral where every mode in the problem is arbitrarily weakly coupled. Because then you're just doing a Gaussian integral, which is boring. Okay? We can have something interesting because there is one mode in the problem, really one matrix worth of modes in the problem, that is strongly interacting, and that drives interesting physics. Okay? So now let's take these words and convert them into formulas. Okay, so what do we want to do? We want to do a path integral of Yang-Mills theory. The first thing we have to do in order to do this is fix gauge. Okay, so let me choose the following gauge. Let me choose del I AI equals 0, the equivalent of Coulomb gauge on the sphere. Okay, that's great. But it doesn't completely fix gauge, because it leaves unfixed gauge transformations that depend only on time. Because those wouldn't affect AI at all. So let me continue to fix gauge by demanding, well, if we were just working without the circle, you might have said we should demand that A0 is 0 at one time. The 0 mode on the 3 sphere of A0 is 0. You see, we can't do anything that's space dependent anymore, but we can set the 0 mode of A0 on the 3 sphere to be anything we want at all times. However, you can't quite do that because holonomy is gauge invariant. So what you can do is to set del 0 of integral of A0 on this 3 sphere to be equal to 0. Okay. These two conditions completely fix gauge. Okay. Now, we are going to take the integral of A0, integral of over the S3, and integral over time. Okay. So let's say that the integral over S3 of A0, the only part of it that we've not set to zero is the part that's constant at time, and we call that alpha. Okay? It's an n cross n matrix. Alpha is an n cross n matrix. Okay. Now, the question we're going to ask before proceeding is, in this process of fixing a gauge, do we land up, for our purposes, with interesting Fabry-Popov determinants? Well, let's look at this guy to start with. Okay? The determinant of the operator that we'll have to compute using the Fabry-Popov trick for this guy, the determinant for this guy would be del I of del I. Right? Because the gauge transformation of AI is del I times a scalar function. So here we would want to compute a determinant of this. This is an interesting operator. However, it is nonlinear. You see, this thing can be thought of as C bar del I squared. And all its nonlinearities depend on massive fields AI. So to the approximation in which we're going to integrate out all massive fields to quadratic order, okay, this thing can be approximated just by the determinant of del squared, which is independent of alpha. Okay? And so we're going to drop it. We're going to compute all of the alpha dependence of this path integral. Is this clear? So this determinant to the order in which we want to compute it is boring and we forget about it. Okay. That same question, the same point is not true of this determinant. The determinant we get from this gauge fixing is more interesting. The reason it's more interesting is that it will depend on alpha. Okay. So how do we see that? Well, suppose you make a gauge transformation on A0. If you make a gauge transformation on A0, actually we're only interested in the constant part of A0. Okay? You make a gauge transformation on A0, it changes by del 0 acting on some scalar function. Okay? So this function here will also be constant of the sphere. The interesting thing is that this function, this object here is a function of time. So what's the determinant that we get? Now, this del zero has alpha naught in it, has alpha in it. So this determinant here, when we expand in Fourier space, is the following object. It's product n not equal to zero. N not equal to zero because we're only fixing the Fourier modes in the time circle that are not zero. We can't fix the zero mode on the time circle. Remember, that's physical. So a product n not equal to zero, and then what do we get? 2 pi I n by beta plus commutator with alpha. Okay, let's move to basis. You see, we've got a single matrix in our game, and a single unitary matrix can always be diagonalized. Okay, so let's move to a basis in which we've diagonalized alpha. So let's say that alpha is equal to alpha 1 up to alpha n. Then commutator with alpha is simply the action of this alpha matrix in the adjoint representation. And the eigenvalues of alpha in the adjoint representation, if the eigenvalues of alpha in the fundamental representation are alpha 1 to alpha n, the eigenvalues of the adjoint representation are alpha I minus alpha j, running over all I and j. Right? So what we want here is a product over all I and j, and then a product of n not equal to 0, 2 pi I n by beta, and actually my convention should be a minus, minus alpha I, minus I, so minus I times alpha I, or something. Okay, now for a given I and j, it's easy to determine this product. You see, well, the first thing you do is to pull out the path. This product doesn't look well defined because it's product over all integers if you ignore this part. It's just clearly divergent. But we're only interested in the alpha dependence. So we can pull that out. So let's pull out a 2 pi I n divided by beta. And then this thing becomes product over I and j. Product n not equal to 0. 1 minus alpha I minus alpha j beta by 2 pi n. Okay, now what's this? Well, a number of you are already, many of you know what the answer to this product is, but let me just motivate it anyway. You see, if we look at this function, it has zeros as a function of alpha I minus alpha j. Think of that as x. Oh, even better, as a function of alpha I minus alpha j beta by 2 pi, think of that as x. It has zeros at every integer value, except n equals 0. Okay? Can you think of another function that has zeros at every integer value except n equals 0? Well, that's a simple one. Turns out to be the right one. It's sine of alpha I minus alpha j by 2 times beta by 2 pi divided by alpha I minus alpha j by 2 beta by 2 pi. Oh, sorry, we probably didn't want the 2 pi, sorry. By 2, sorry, no 2 pi's. Because sine itself has zeros at integer values. Okay? And you can convince yourself in many ways that this is the right answer. The simplest way is to look up Gradstein and Rijik. Okay, so this quantity here is simply a product, is simply a sine divided by alpha I minus alpha j. Well, now that's an interesting answer for the following reason. A reason that you will appreciate most clearly if you do the following exercise. So this is an exercise I want to suggest to anyone who's interested, and of course I'd love to discuss it with anyone who's interested. It's the exercise. Suppose we were doing an integral over all Hermitian matrices. DH. Okay? And by this integral I mean the following. I mean integral of D, the real part, of D of HII, the diagonal parts of the Hermitian matrix, and then the product over I, this is product over I, the product of I less than j, D real part of Hij, the imaginary part of Hij. Okay, so I just mean product of the elements of the matrix, element by element, except by taking care of the fact that the matrix is Hermitian. So not all elements of the matrix are independent. So I've only done an integral over the independent. Okay, now suppose I was interested in doing this matrix integral, and I thought of this matrix integral as being gauged by unitary transformations. Then we could always make a choice of gauge to set this integral to be diagonal. The Hermitian matrix to be diagonal. That choice of gauge picks up a Fadi Popov determinant. The exercise is to compute that Fadi Popov determinant. Show that this is the same thing as d alpha d h1 d dhi. Hi are the eigenvalues of H. Okay, times, there's some number that is not a concern to us. I not equal to J, Hi minus J. Okay, the second exercise, so this is part one of the exercise. Part two of the exercise is if you were doing the same thing over unitary integrals. Okay, show that, and where the eigenvalues of unitary integral are e to the power I theta I. I is equal to 1 to n. The exercise is to show that this, if you do the same gauge fixing on this unitary integral, you get this is equal to product over I d theta I, and then product I not equal to j, sine of theta I minus theta j divided by 2. Now, why have I started telling you about all of this? It seems like a break in topic. It's not a break in topic because, you see, what we found here is precisely this product divided by this product for an appropriate choice of U and H. What is H? H in our situation was just A naught, or alpha. What was U? U was e to the power I beta alpha. Okay? So if you treat H as this and U as this, you see, the original integral we had to do in our Yang-Mills, the original Yang-Mills integral we had to do was an integral over all Hermitian matrices alpha. But the Fadi Popov determinant gives us precisely that factor which converts this integral into instead an integral over the unitary matrices e to the power I beta alpha. Is this clear? So there's only one important effect of Fadi Popov gauge fixing when you do it in this way, and that is to convert the integral in your answer over alpha naught into an integral over holonomies. An integral over holonomies. This is basically just the holonomy of the A naught gauge field. Okay? We know from various purposes that this had to work. It's sort of nice to see it work explicitly, you know, using gauge fixing. Okay, good. So that was the effect of gauge fixing on our story. So let's summarize so far what we've seen. So far, what have we seen? We've seen that z of beta is equal to integral du, where u was times some effective action, which is a function of u. That effective action, which is a function of u, will be obtained at our one loop approximation by integrating out all the massive modes of Yang-Mills theory to give us that effective action as a function of u. So our next job is to compute this effect. Is this clear? Questions, comments, remarks? Okay. Good. Now, the computation of S effective as a function of U is a little algebra, but it's actually very simple. I'll very briefly outline it and then give you the result. You see, how does this go? Well, for instance, let's look at the contribution from the gauge fields. The spatial parts of the gauge fields, the spatial parts of the gauge fields can be expanded in a series of vector spherical harmonics on the sphere. Okay? Really vector spherical harmonics, no gradients of scalars, because of our gauge condition, del I equals zero. Okay? So there is a standard expansion of AI in terms of vector spherical harmonics. Let's call the coefficients of that expansion. I won't even go into the details. You know, it can be done. You can find it in papers I could give you references to. But there are some, this vector spherical harmonics are labeled by actually J, M1, and M2. Some number here, M1 and M2, and also some integer 1 and 2. Okay? And you can expand AI in terms of vector spherical harmonics. The key point in this expansion is that once you do that, at quadratic order, the action diagonalizes. Okay? So it becomes a bunch of harmonic oscillators, one for the coefficients of each vector spherical harmonic. Okay? So, the form of the action takes the following form for any one of the vector spherical harmonics. Minus, let's call that the coefficient A, mod A squared times some delta squared, some number, minus D0 of A, the whole thing squared. Plus. Where D0 is the time covariant derivative and is the only thing in the game that knows about alpha. Okay, great. Now, now once we've broken up the problem like this, we just have to do the path integral mode by mode in these A's. Still a path integral because these A's depend on time. Okay? So you do that path integral, and what do you get? So what you get is, for one of these, you get, well, for each of these, you get product n equals minus infinity to infinity, 1 over delta squared plus alpha as a commutator, plus I n by 2 pi by beta. The whole thing. Well, once you get the signs right, there's no I and no beta. You get something like this. Okay, now this alpha as a commutator sounds strange, but you can go to the basis where it's diagonal, and then this just becomes alpha I minus alpha j. Okay? And then you want to do this product, and you do it by using, by massaging this product into factors of the form in which you can use this formula. Okay? It's a little painful to go through in detail, but it's utterly straightforward, especially if you have Grashtin and Rajik by your side. And so let me just give you the final answer. The final answer is, dropping everything that's not dependent on alpha. Yeah, you can, and of course you can do everything more carefully by keeping track of counter terms and computing the full thing. For my purpose, I'm only interested in alpha dependence. Okay. So dropping everything that's independent of alpha, what you get? You get that this path integral is exponential, the answer to this path integral, exponential of trace of minus trace of log of 1 minus e to the power minus beta delta times u in the adjoint. Several comments are in order. You see, this u in, had you just done this integral, instead of getting this trace and u in the adjoint, we would have said, actually, so just this integral is exponential of minus log of 1 minus e to the power minus beta delta alpha I, e to the power I alpha I minus alpha j, j times beta. Okay? But then we also have to take the product over all I and j. The product becomes a sum in the exponent, and I use the fact that the trace of any function of a matrix is the sum of the function of that matrix for every eigenvalue. Okay? So these are the eigenvalues of u in the adjoint. So this is an invariant way of writing this summed over all I and j. Is this clear? Okay? So it's 10 minutes of algebra if you have Grashtin-Rajik you to do this, from, go from here to here, and this is the moin variant way of writing. This is true for every mode. We also have to do in the exponent the sum over all modes. See, this was one particular mode with a particular energy delta. Okay, so the final answer is really the following. Final answer is really the following.
Yeah. I have this board down.
Which one? This one?
Yeah, yeah. Thanks.
Okay, it's really so S Yang Mills of as a function of U is equal to sum over all modes. Sum over all modes trace of minus trace of log of 1 minus e to the power minus beta times delta of that mode times U adjoint. Okay. Now, that thing can be, this thing can be simplified. We simplify it by Taylor series expanding this log and collecting all the terms with the same U dependence.
Are you summing over all the scalars and fermions?
Yes. This thing should be summed over all scalars. Actually, with fermions, you have to do the whole process again, and you get a slightly different answer. Okay, so this is modes which are scalars. The full answer is plus sum over, now with a plus trace of log of 1 plus e to the power minus beta. This is modes fermions.
Presumably you don't have a finite answer unless you add the two together.
No, the alpha dependence is finite anyway.
Just the alpha.
Just the alpha dependence. Yes. Okay. So, I haven't gone through it with you, but you can go through this whole determinant business again with the fermions, and you get some differences. This plus here reflects the fact that the determinant, when you do fermions, is a numerator rather than a denominator. Okay, so that's why these have opposite signs. And this thing is something a little more subtle, which I won't get into now. Okay, so this is the full answer. Now you can take each of these logs and expand it in a power series. Take each of these logs, expand it in a power series. Okay? And collect all terms with the same U dependence. Also yields the fact that trace of U in the adjoint is equal to trace U times trace U dagger, where when I don't specify an index, I mean U in the fundamental. Really, if we were doing SUN, there would be an additional minus 1. Well, let's say we're doing UN, or we're working the large N limit, where we don't care about minus 1s. Okay? So, when you do this and do the expansion, you can rewrite S Yang Mills as a function of U as sum over n fs of n beta by n fs of n beta by n plus minus 1 to the power n plus 1 ff of n beta by n times trace u dagger. Where all I've done is expand each of these logarithms in the power series and collect together terms with U, where and I've defined two new symbols. I've defined fs of beta to be sum over all scalar modes, e to the power minus beta delta mode. And similarly, ff of beta is equal to sum over all fermionic modes, e to the power minus beta of, times delta of mode.
This was leading order in the expansion.
This is leading order in the perturbative expansion. But it's exact otherwise. Okay? So there's no approximation made except for the fact that we've dealt with all massive modes only at one loop. In the next lecture, we'll talk about how that gets changed when we look at higher loops. But this is already an interesting answer. Now, is it time to stop?
Less out of time.
Yes. Okay. So maybe I should just stop here. And Okay, the last part of this lecture has been a little technical. We'll try to avoid more of that in these, just so that we have a calculation. Okay? This answer I presented to you not because the calculation was so enthrallingly interesting, though of course all of you agree that it is, but because it's an interesting answer, we'll see why the answer's interesting next time. Okay.
Any questions, skeptical comments? Welcome.
The formula you have for is effective looks like a grand canonical partition sum with a chemical potential given by your joint.
Yes.
Is there a way to see that directly?
Yeah. You see, with a chemical potential being given by the stress U, you're saying, by U adjoint.
Yeah.
You see, yes. One way of dealing with chemical potentials is to take, you see, suppose you had stuff with a given charge. Let's say you had a scalar field with a charge E. You wanted to weight the modes with that charge. One way of doing that is by doing path integral with twisted boundary conditions. Okay? Where you twist the modes such that the boundary conditions of these scalar fields, as you go down, you pick up a factor of e to the power I, E, for each mode of positive sign, if power. Okay? Now, you see, what U is exactly that twist. Of course, it's more interesting than just a scalar charge. It's like a non-abelian twist. Okay? So, it's precisely the reason, I mean, formally, it's basically the same thing.
Any more questions? Okay, let's thank Shiraz again. Those of you that are going to speak in the gong show this evening, can you just...